and welcome to this episode of the Spring Podcast. I think this is something like episode 13 in terms of the rounds, but we've had like specials in between. So just go look up yourself. Don't expect us to hold your hand for everything, right? So we just want to give a bit of a quick plug for the last few episodes there. We had a special episode last week with Colin McMaster from McLean. If you haven't done so already, please go and check that out. Some great stories there. Also want to give a shout out to a couple of other podcasts. Before we kick off, just as usual, stage by stage, Trevor has had a couple of more guests on in the meantime. He's had Richard Ascott and John McLean. And John McLean was a technician during Petter Solberg's championship here in 03 with Subaru. So very interesting stuff there. Also want to give a shout out to Crunching Gears, Kevin Denning's podcast, which is really, really good. He did an interview with Frank Kelly lately, which was great. And there's a new one on the scene as well, the Irish Rally podcast by Kevin Regan. I think there's only one episode out so far, but it's really, really good. Be sure and check those out across the various platforms if you haven't done so already. Next week, we'll have a special episode with Niall McShea, who was competing in the JWRC during 2001. Some brilliant stories there from both this era, competing against Alexis Sebastian Loeb and Francois Duval and all the other guys who were around at the time, as well as his, how he got started in the sport and what he did after 2001. So be sure and check that out next week. So we've got a big crew this week. We've got Art McCarrick back with us once again.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Tommy's here.
Well.
And William has also turned up.
Hello. What was the last one I missed?
The last one I was on. Oh no!
Yeah.
You weren't. I'm on a run. There's four people here. The boom is back.
Are you like the Marco Martin of our podcast? If we're the Subaru World Rally team, this is the four car entry, and you've been floating in and out of it. Will, you've been fairly present, but missing.
Calling us Subaru now. We're like.
Can I stop there? I'm delighted to get that comparison to Marco Martin. I'll take that any day of the week.
I'm Akin Martel, so if that's the case.
I'll take Pierre Aliati. We're going back in time, small bit there. I'll take Pierre
Aliati. Yeah, I'd be happy enough with Passenburn or something like that.
Great. This podcast though is brought to you by Mac O'Martin, Akin Martel, Passenburn, and Pierre Aliati.
Yes, I'm delighted.
Only one of which was actually competing in this rally, I believe.
Passenburn.
Yeah. Good old Passenburn.
Martel actually.
He was, yeah. Martel.
Wow. Yeah. The Martel of Israeli, he didn't, did he?
He did.
What?
Yeah.
Mortal Kombat.
In an S7, car 30.
No way. Oh, jeez,
yeah.
There he is.
Yeah, way.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, way.
That was a big, big old show from.
It's himself, all right.
It's himself, all right, yeah.
Big attack,
yeah.
The Grant landed.
Okay, jeez. We're jumping the gun there with the intro list, but sure, look, here we are. So, yeah, we're on to the penultimate round of the 2001 season, Rally Australia. And just, again, looking at the championship the way it was, mathematically, six drivers had a chance of the title with two rounds left to go. Now, some had obviously, a greater chance than others. At the head of the leaderboard was McRae and Mäkinen, then Burns, Sainz, and then we had Rovan Pär and Panizzi. No, I think it was, as we've mentioned previously, it would have been absolutely scandalous if Panizzi won the championship in 2001. But mathematically, it was a possibility, which just again demonstrates how crazy this year was.
Mathematically, it was also a possibility that McRae could win the championship on this rally. If he won this rally and Mäkinen didn't finish, he couldn't be bet because McRae would have had more wins. So McRae could have won it in Australia.
Which is well, I think when we get closer into day two, we can probably spin up another theory of why McRae didn't win the title in 2001. I would solely blame that one man.
But even when you looked at the recent form of Mitsubishi, their most recent Lancer that they decided to enter the last quarter of the season with, you would have, if you were Colin McRae going into Australia, you'd kind of have to fancy your chances of possibly tying it up, all things going away.
No, right. Definitely. It's a rally he would have done well on in the past. The running order obviously vital, and that brings us neatly onto the next point. Australia, the stages are really, really tricky. They have this kind of like really fine gravel, almost like little ball bearings on the top, the very top of the road. We'll say. So the first couple of cars are basically sweeping them off, and it's like even slippier than you know, the mud of GB or even the ice of Sweden or snow of Sweden or whatever. It's, there's just no grip whatsoever. So, like, we've seen it on numerous rallies in 2001, and to this day, still the running order is a big issue in these kind of events. But they came up with a novel system for this round where the championship leader picked their starting position before the first leg, and then the rally leader for days, the end of day of each day, picked their starting position for the subsequent leg, we'll say. So, and as we get to throw at the event, that did play a big part of proceedings, but probably a good solution, all things considered. Like the stages themselves, were quite, you know, they're tricky stages. Like, they're not the most enjoyable by the looks of it. They're quite quick, but there's lots of trees really, really close to the road. They're, you know, it's a challenging event. Like, it's not a driver's rally really by any means.
It's kind of a contradiction because it's such a high speed rally, but the grip levels seem to be so variable depending on your road position. And for a high speed rally with danger so close to the edge of the road, you know, some drivers seem to thrive fairly well there, you know, but others kind of seem to struggle with it.
But even with this, and it's actually something people, maybe more younger fans or more modern ones, wouldn't know the difference of. Maybe the geography of it, this event being based in Perth, in the modern day Australian event down around Coffs Harbour. So you're talking
opposite sides of the country.
They're completely opposite. And even if you look at Western Australia, it's just, did I hear that right before, that it's the same size as landmass as Europe?
Yeah, just Western Australia. Yeah, it's fucking ridiculously big, Australia is.
It's terrifying. I did a short drive from where they come into Sydney down to Melbourne, and that's a short spin, 12 and a half hours in a shitty of a camper van with no air
conditioning. Christ, God help you.
So I feel their pain. If you, I know what it's like to rattle down in a tin can with no air conditioning in that heat.
Yeah. Was that the one you were left with breaking as well on your travels?
That was another one, yeah, because this one, it's a well known bad campervan rental company, and we were stuck last minute in Australia. We needed one for a week. You probably have seen the pictures of it. I won't mention any more detail on that just in case, so they get offended, but everyone hates them anyway, so they're wicked campers. No.
How are they still in business? Is that their modus operandi is just to be the worst campervan rental company in Australia?
I'll give you an example. They're actually banned from a lot of festivals in New Zealand and Australia because people get so offended by them. Like, we had one with Mickey Mouse on the side of it flipping people off. On the back of it, there was something written like, you think the outside is bad, the inside is worse, and we're coming to get you. This was, and badly, it's as if 6 year-olds graffiti, this thing. We were stuck, we had to get one. We said, right, we got this. And then, yeah, that was one of the ones I decided to drive the shit out of because the clutch was at its end. And as it turned out, we weren't supposed to get that one. Anyway,
there's graffiti on it. So, like, basically, you're driving around in an obscene publication.
Absolutely, yeah. It would have been less offensive to have Hooters on the side of it or something, or Penthouse or something, you
know?
But either way, look, that van got the Delacroix treatment down into some of the nice wooded areas down around the south.
Oh my God.
I'm kind of even sorry.
God. Interesting business model there out of that company, whoever they are. So I'm sure some of our Australian or Kiwi listeners might know. Shout out to them, actually. We actually have listeners from pretty much every continent, or Antarctica at this stage. Not sure how we're going
to do that
particular thing, but they're even coming from Gdansk to listen to the podcast. So, so
taken the long way by southern, taken. Came by southern Yemen, yeah.
Yeah. So doing important work in space for NASA as well. So. Anyway, shall we? We'll tear on to the event. As you mentioned, they're based in Perth. Around this period, that meant that they were using the Langley Park Super Special, and like, it's interesting to note that for a Super Special, it's actually had a pretty pivotal, you know, part in rallying history. When you look at it, if you look at 1995, there, that was where it became abundantly clear that Toyota were a big shot of cheating bastards. where the
bizarre irregularities of their acceleration.
Bizarre turbo irregularities.
Yeah. Oh, it was absolutely. It's actually worth checking that out.
That extra mass airflow was just resting in my turbo accelerator.
Yes. it's worth checking out the Top Gear bit. Chris Harris did a special on the interview season. It's actually really, really good. And Absolute Rally have done a brilliant podcast, a couple of podcasts on the 95 season as well. Worth checking those out as well. But you can see like the car, you can't make it any more obvious. Like the Celica was two car lengths ahead of an Impreza there by the end of the straight. I know the Impreza mightn't traditionally have had the strongest engine, but that was, you know, that was beyond all comprehension at the time. You know, there was definitely something dodgy going on there.
TT, would you like to use the normal turbo? No, there's no demand for it. It's shite.
It's shite, yeah. All right. That's approximately 15 featherhead references crammed into the first 10 minutes of the podcast.
Sure. Tremendous work.
Tremendous lesson. We need to cram all them in. We've only two rallies left.
Yeah, I know. Jesus, yeah, we'd have listed them to get through. But anyway. Yeah, so as you see, Langley Park was pivotal as well throughout this event, as we'll get to that slightly further on in this episode. The route was 21 stages, which is, you know, thereabouts for the Euro, with the last day kind of entirely based around, I think, is it called Sotico / Bunnings? And we'd like to give a shout out to Bunnings stores there for providing us with the snags, which I believe are just an Australian version of a roll with a sausage and some stuff inside in it. So they're this week's sponsor. So we're talking into them at the moment.
Victorious.
Yeah. So anything interesting in the interlist there, guys?
73 entries made up the 2001 Rally Australia, comprising of 38 cars, with 14 of them being works cars. Skoda didn't make the trip down to the Southern Hemisphere again, due to unsubstantiated rumours about, you know, lack of tyres due to Armin Schwartz. Not proven, not disproven.
I don't think the Skoda would have liked being an overweight car down in the
and you can be fairly sure the Skodas would have had a terrible road close or road opening the way things were going. Poor Hyundai got shafted.
Speaking of that point about Skoda having a crap road order, you'd think it would have been an advantage to one of the top teams to maybe pay for them to go down, do the road sweeping, because those two cars would do one hell of a sweep, slot straight in behind them, job done.
They probably wipe a couple of trees out of it as well.
That's a fucking serious point.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I've another point about switching stuff around later when we get
to it. Tactics, isn't it? Yeah.
It is all tactics.
Well, Ericsson returned anyway from more hardship of sweeping the roads like Trigger and Money Fools and Horses. Subaru entered four cars, as did Peugeot. The four cars for Subaru were the usual suspects of Burns, Solberg, Arai, and Marco Martin, whereas Peugeot, interestingly, entered a fourth car for Gilles Panizzi. And the only other change to the lineup of the works teams was actually with Mitsubishi in the co-driver seat for Tommy Mäkinen, where Timo Huntinen substituted for Risto Mäntymäki. Huntinen would have been a co-driver for Sebastian Lindholm on several of his WRC events in the 206 prior to this and back in Finland, but he was called in to substitute for the injured Mäntymäki.
Good moustache as well.
Cracking moustache.
Good moustache, nice and tidy.
I reckon in the 80s he was definitely in a Finnish synth operation.
Absolutely.
He's a Bob off Tapio Loganen, is
it? No, he didn't have as good a mullet, to be fair.
Yeah.
He actually didn't have one, you know.
Yeah, Loganen had a good do in fairness to him back in the 90s. Yeah.
Hey, Tommy, did you say Marco Martin was in for this?
I think I did. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'm just looking
could
there.
Wrong. It could be an oversight on that.
Looking there, I can't see.
You're not half wrong. I'd say you could be wrong this time, though, kid.
I actually, because it came out, because I have it in my notes here, between, what was the last round? Corsica.
Yeah.
Between Corsica and this, it was announced that Martin was joining Ford. So I don't know if Martin had ended with Subaru now. I don't know if he does GB. I'm not sure. And Ford also announced they'd signed Duval, who's on the entry list in a Group N car. He used to do 11 events the following year. So Martin had jumped ship. Fairly pivotal move for him, actually. And
the point of Duval, I know, was he on your list, Tommy? I'm assuming he was. But it was a bit of an odd entry to go down to Australia in an Evo 6 for Duval.
Well, if he was going doing the World Championship the next year, you know.
Experience, yeah.
Especially
in the forward drive car.
What's that? I was surprised he was air skating on the plane.
Did they tell him he was going on a stag in Prague or something? And just like about 4 hours into the flight, they kind of, I don't know, did they feed him a bit of a sedative or something? And you know, because if he realised he was flying more or less a day to get to Oz to do a rally, he probably would have kicked up a fuss. But sure.
He's the Mr. T of the WRC. But anyway,
that's the style of the man, yeah.
Privateers, we actually had a couple of local entries in World Cars. Neil Bates in the Corolla World Rally Car, Possum Bourne from New Zealand, so Australasian entry in an S6 World Car, and plenty of Corollas with the likes of Hassie Hagstrom, Henrik Lundgaard, whose son Christian Lundgaard actually raced very impressively in the F2 race in Austria at the weekend.
Teams Cup winner Lundgaard, I'm sure, was he?
He was ERC winner in 2000.
When it was actually cool, and that's something we'll do a podcast on in the future, when the European Championship was full of
fags. 200 events.
Yeah, 200 events and coefficient 5 events. So that is kind of cool.
I go off and do a rally in Latvia to get those points, you know.
Yeah. And Eurosport, you might get a 7-minute snippet of it in Eurosport there some night, and you'll be to keep you going for a month.
So
solid stuff now. You see an Escort Cosworth in a livery you'd never even dreamt of before, and to just blow your mind. We'll definitely do something on that in the future.
Couple of interesting entries. In Group N, there was 33 entries. Cody Crocker obviously did a Humpty Dumpty job and actually managed to put his car back together again after New Zealand. Marco Ipati, the BRC champion from 2000, was entered in Impreza. Ex-Subaru Junior team driver Juha Kangas was entered. And as guys mentioned already, Francois Duval was entered in an Evo 6. Manfred Stoll was also entered too. But we've some Irish interest actually in the rally. The Hannigans entered in Class A6 in a Sharia GTI. And I know Finian Hannigan, those who are familiar with the Irish Forest Rally, and Finian would have navigated for Patsy Keenan, who comes back from the US and they would have won Group M years ago. So he's the brother or cousin of them. But those guys were in Class A6. And the most obscure thing in the entry were a pair of Vivios, Subaru Vivios. Probably seen often since the Safari.
Do you know what? I reckon that car would be the most fun to drive in those stages.
Why?
Because you definitely have the road swept anyway. You'd be far, the ideal road position. There's plenty of tracks to follow.
It's about a foot narrower than the track of every other out there, so you'd actually be road swept for yourself.
Sure, yeah. No, but said, if you're running anywhere early, if they ran them before the forward drives, which I'm assuming they did, we were like we talked about in San Remo, the joy of not having to hold a forward drive car back, just driving a little shitbox on the limit between trees. It's how we all grow.
There is a lot of pleasure to be gained from driving an underpowered, slow car with no grip,
huge.
Because you can have fun in it at 22 miles an hour.
I'm still convinced that my first car, 1 liter 106, that I'm driving quicker than I do now.
I suppose your expectations are lower, and I think everyone's expectations of you are lower too.
The only expectation of anyone as a 17-year-old young fella learn to drive is that he's going to hit the oak. Like,
I never did.
anything beyond crashing is a bonus.
I flirted with the line so many times in that car, it actually amazed me how I never crashed it.
Yeah.
So that wasn't the only flirting you were doing with the car, but
careful now.
Risky, Tom.
Risky, yeah. Whoa, family podcast.
The other girls might get offended.
Yes.
just looking there at the entry as well. There's another interesting one there, one of them Group N entries. Dean Herridge, he did, if I'm not mistaken, he was a stage end reporter on WRC Live for a rally or two.
That sounds really familiar, actually, yeah.
He did Monte Carlo at the start. He was actually brilliant. It was when George Donaldson left and we were trying to find a kind of replacement. And then they decided to do away with rally radio altogether and go all live. He did that for a while. He was good. And going back to the Daihatsu charades, the car 78 and 79, two-car team of Daihatsu charades, entered by the Australian Office of Youth Affairs.
No, sir. Yeah,
like well, whatever. Like, whether it was some.
A two-car team in Rally Ireland entered by Cork County Council.
Or Faroica or something.
Yeah. The local youth club or something, yeah.
We'd be there shaving ourselves like mad and, you know, trying to get
a free entry, yeah.
Whole heap of Group N cars, but I suppose that kind of reflected the Asia Pacific region and Subaru and Mitsubishi is probably the most Group N cars there was in anyone.
Yeah, sure. There was the one out for Subarus and Mitsubishi's down there. There's a huge import scene in Australia, obviously being right and drive as well. You know, they actually used to get a lot of, you know, Australasia specific models from Japan as well, you know, not just the straight JDM stuff. Like they had, and they obviously had the stuff from Hornets and Fords and all that kind of crack, in case it's carrying some sort of food
they're unbelievably strict on import and export cars. So you'd probably find it actually probably economical to bring things in as rally cars in parts.
But actually, looking back even to what you were saying, Art, about the 33 entries in four. It was a similar enough story in the New Zealand event. So it's kind of a Pacific thing, really, because the fact that it was probably the height of, you know, Mitsubishi versus Subaru, you know, and the thing that went from the stages to the car parks, you know, this was it. You could drive a car on the road that was in the rally, you know, was only two steps away from it.
Delacour's last event for four as well. I think it was because they were bringing Higgins in for Mark Higgins in for GB. So the end of a very successful year for Delacour, to be fair. He'd had a good, consistent run. Just a pity he didn't get a better seat for 02. They confirmed, actually, this point that he was moving to Mitsubishi for 2002, along with Alistair, and Freddie Likes was going to Hyundai, that set. Just that there was kind of some of the last bits of the driver market being tidied up. So onto the start of the event, and as we mentioned, the Hyundais were first on the road owing to their championship positions. Absolute disaster for him. Ericsson even had a window seal fail in his car. So there was as much dust inside the car as there was outside. So can't imagine that was too pleasant. Granholm was absolutely flying. It's interesting to watch Granholm throughout this event, actually. From Finland onwards in 2001, you know, the 206 was by far and away the quickest car. If you look at the events and how they panned out and just the edge wins, all that sort of stuff, the signs were there that 2000 they'd really got their act together again after a shaky start to the season, and the car was going to be, you know, the one to beat in 2002. Obviously Bourne said, you know, there was rumors that the deal wasn't legally done at this stage, but Burns was more or less confirmed to be moving to Peugeot at this point, which might have put a bit of a rocket up Granholm's hole as well. He might have been spurred on that a little bit extra by this as well, but he was pretty much uncatchable for this rally. And even at steering issues in day one, he was complaining, and even then he was still leading for most of the day. So pretty ominous sign for what was to come in 2002.
Yeah, even on that, I know I don't want to do a spoiler enough, but looking at the way Granholm performed over the event, he took the lead on stage 7, and I think he only dropped more than 1 second in his overall lead time between there and Sunday. That's incredible.
We could talk about it now, because it's the drive of the definitely the drive of the event. He actually said on the second day, I think they fixed the steering issue on the second day, and they'd done some work with the differentials since New Zealand, as far as I know. The last kind of rough event or the last gravel event, and he said at that point the second day of Rally Australia was the best day of rallying he'd ever done in his career. Every's one of those times when everything clicked. Joe, the notes are right, his driving was spot on, and the car was working perfectly. And you can see that, like, he hit so much in reserve. Granama was drove like a guy who had a bit in reserve anyway.
Yeah.
But he was cruising here and still taking chunks of time. Like, no one could, even Burns was pushing and pushing, trying to catch him throughout the event. Couldn't get near him, neither could anyone else. Interesting to note, Ariel had a 6-speed box as well for this event. They didn't actually make too much of a fuss about it, but you can see on one part of the coverage, he flicks into sixth. Well, it shows up in the display and the dashing, so maybe this. yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Maybe they were just trying to call him.
I never noticed it first, but from a homologation point of view, what's the story with going an extra gear?
They must have had the two boxes homologated. Yeah.
There'd be nothing wrong with them running the 6-speed, because that's what it originally had at the start of the season. And whenever they upgraded it,
I thought it was
the 5-speed box.
I thought it was always
5-speed. It came in this year. Yeah, so they just threw in the 6-speed box and it would have been homologated for the car.
Sure, yeah. It's
interesting to note, everyone at the time talked about how strong the Peugeot engine was, and this is another, I suppose, example of it, that it could get away with running a 5-speed box. It had the torque to do it. No other car ran a 5-speed box, I'd say, till zero. Well, obviously, the 307 did, but I think 2005, I'd say, was it? Yeah.
06 Focus did eventually. I don't think it did at the start.
The 05 Lancer did as well, I'm sure, and the Fabia. But that was another few years of development then again. So, Joe, at this point, the 206 had a, you know, crazy, crazy strong engine to be able to do that, but didn't suit. And you can hear it. You can hear it in the some of the audio clips. You know, there is a noticeable difference in the gear ratios when they change up or whatever compared to the other cars. But just another example of how strong that car, the engine.
Like the shot of the clip of Granholm going off, I think is the first stage on Friday morning or first or second one, and he's kind of sitting at the top of the ruts and the camera's in from the side, and you just it literally sounds, I know, like a one, some class of wild animal. That's just
screwed up. 100%.
But
Peugeot kind of had to, because they had nothing to fight for, only the manufacturers, and they had enough of... Ariel was starting to perform now, so they were like, right, we'll give him fancy gearbox to shut him up. Robin Pera, he's doing great. He's doing better than we ever thought he would. And we'll turn up Granholm's car a bit and go and see, because clearly they had sorted all the overheating, melting stuff that it was doing at the beginning of the year. A bit of reliability was coming into it now.
And sure, what, there were three in the top five after...
Even Panizzi was doing
well. It was good going already, rather than just single driver and Granholm. The whole team were doing serious job in Australia.
Like, the only thing that noticeable about it was actually Rovan Pera. Like, his performance was very impressive, but even he was complaining that he had picked the wrong tyres. He'd find that he was going on too soft a tyre at times, that he felt that he could probably have been closer to the front than he actually was. And like, his pace on day one was very impressive, like, for someone who, okay, he'd been there a few times with the SEAT teams and, you know, the F2 and the Cordoba days, but, you know, fantastic to be up at that level in the car again. Another kind of display of how impressive he'd been all year, you know, in what was a surprise addition to the Peugeot team, really.
And if that's his worst complaint, Tommy, that wrong tyres, you know, how bad?
Yeah.
Tell you
what, considering the problems they had, like, at
times. While you're talking about additions to the Peugeot team, can we just talk about their hats for a minute?
Oh yeah. Style icon.
And they had the little Peugeot lion on them as well. I thought, Ariel and Provera just had the same hat. And then when Provera was interviewed, you'd see his hat with the little Peugeot lion on it.
We're talking about the same hat, because it's like Crocodile D goes to Ibiza or something.
Crocodile Dundee meets Kevin and Perry.
Yeah, because yes. He's got the glasses on as well.
It's a crossover we've all been waiting for.
Paul Hogan and Ian Appa.
Yeah. To get her at
Jane Bowers, man.
Yeah. No, it is top notch. I wonder where all that merchandise actually ended up, you know, because you'd imagine that.
You can still get bits on eBay. There's a guy whose shop I follow on it there, and a lot of his stuff, Pewter Sports stuff, he comes up the most random bits, and they're genuine team merchandise, bits. Proper team bits. Yeah.
You can still get the most up to date 20-year-old gear and a lot of trucks.
I'd say myself and Morris Norman in Italy who might be able to get us one.
Yeah, you would have to remortgage the host to get it. That's the only problem.
Yeah, that's the thing. But yeah.
It'll be there, but by God, you'd pay for it.
It's we were talking about where I got the old Mitsubishi jacket at the classic car show in the NEC. That's where you pick up all the old stuff. Like I got that. We were talking about that earlier in the series. That was brand new, like that was an original Mitsubishi merchandise wrapping and everything. They had loads of Subaru, everything all back from the '90s.
Telluher is very good for getting that old stuff too. I don't know if it was on this year, maybe it got cancelled before the world went to shite. Race Retro over in
Stoneleigh.
I went over to that a few years ago. Oh, you get some unreal stuff at it. Like really, really good stuff. Well worth going to.
So if you see three or four lads on the side of a ditch somewhere, you see one with a rally art jacket, one with some sort of Peugeot sport gear. Art will probably have a Ratman's port kind of a thing, and I'd know I'd turn up with something as
I
well.
Have that.
Yeah, you know exactly who to avoid.
You know the heavies are in town.
The heavies, the idiots.
My Oscar Svedlund Subaru Sweden jacket.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Is a lad beside us in a leather jacket, black leather jacket and a pint. You're doing a bit of spectating, right?
Yeah. We're doing a bit of podcasting.
Yeah. Look at him there.
Yeah, shout out to Tommy Schlug. Yeah. Anyway, back to the rally. The rally, yeah.
And I'll finish up. He finished first, second, third championship in Wales, so.
All right, thanks, Will.
Giving us one of the most iconic scenes of the year, giving us absolute Dixie on the road down with three wheels on his wagon.
Yeah.
Sparks flying everywhere, and the cops just following him in as kind of, you know, an escort. Not stopping him, just off you go.
He wasn't in an escort, Tommy. He was in a Focus.
I think the fact that he wasn't a Ford, these guys must have been Ford men. If they were Holden fans,
they would have done him.
It's actually a good fight, it was a fairly innocuous tip, it wasn't what you'd call a rally ending, you know, hit by any means, but just wherever it hit, broke something in the right rear suspension. And, you know, by the end of the stage, the right rear strut was just hanging out of the car, like dragging a boat anchor behind it almost. And the road section, then, as you said, sparks flying, so there's nearly gouging a bit of a divot in the tire and everything. And she actually went up in fire a small bit at one point, but they got it back anyway. And Jesus, the car was fairly bad, but then they got the service.
Yeah, they had to rip the door off and everything.
The door skin was pulled off and the sill was fucked. And you know,
I think Sainz even said that the car, he had to stop and put out fires like two times on the way there.
It just shows the difference between professional top level rallying and what we'd be doing at home. Again, you know, if any of us even attempted to drive into service with something like that, we'd probably be banned from the sport.
Rallying is a poorer place without it now. Super Rally has killed that kind of adventure.
I
pull off a near similar feat in Clarny the second time I ever did it. I came along the road section and all my wheel nuts decided they'd had enough. We pulled in with the car rocking, couldn't figure out what was going on. I said, went to check everything, check the shock mounts, opened the bonnet, put it back down, nothing. I drove off the road again. Bonnet came up, smashed the windscreen, and the front left wheel had went that way just before it, and then the bonnet came up. We still finished.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Was that on the Healy Pass?
No, it was coming into Kilmacalog, actually.
All right.
We finished it. Don't ask us how, because I can't tell you.
Yeah.
bizarre irregularities in his.
we got the chopper just to go in behind us, you know.
Actually, while we're on day one here and talking about stuff, Mäkinen, and I don't think I've ever seen a co-driver get so much abuse in a program from every angle.
Everyone was getting turned on to me.
It was referred to in the commentary. Mäkinen says it a few times in interviews. Andrew Cowan even says, I actually made a note of this, and I couldn't believe he said it. The person is interviewing him, and obviously says, you know, it's co-driver of the car, all of this. Andrew Cowan says, rather than focus on the car, I would focus on the co-driver that's not used to Tommy's driving. Like, and he was a good co-driver. He had just done Finland with Sebastian Lindholm and finished eighth. And I did a whole year. But
I don't know it's his fault that the car is shite. It's his fault.
Mitsubishi
incorporated value engineering in the construction process of that car.
the true the co-driver under Tommy Schlug's bus.
Talk about it, yeah. And then Ross ran back over with the bus again to make sure.
The poor fella. I thought he got an awful doing in the coverage.
Awful doing.
And clearly driven by Mitsubishi and their PR or whatever. They were just all told to toe this line. The car can't be bad.
Just panic stations, I'd say, at that stage. They'd realise that they had, in essence, made a tub of shit. Mäkinen did forget about the party line there to start and did comment that the car feels big and heavy. And, you know, no, the engine, I've actually seen Ryan Champion, who would know what he's talking about with this kind of stuff, and the Gravel Crew group there, I think it was earlier on today, comment on a post about the Evo 7 World Rally car saying that the engine was crazy strong. And you can kind of hear that. You can hear, Jesus, man, there's some bang off it. Like, but obviously, everything around us is not up to scratch.
It's a strong enough built car, I'd say, because like, you look at the slap he gave the post on the first day. There's a right-hander where he's coming down, so it almost tightens to a 90 left. Tightens to 90 left. And there's a post on the outside, and he hits it an unmerciful slap. Nothing, just breaks it out. It's a bit like the Volvo 940 or rally cars in some regards.
Yeah, he was lucky where he hit that as well, Tommy. Like, he just got that on the petrol cam.
Yeah, if you hit that in the wheel, or something, it could have been a bit worse. But again, we have to remember as well that Mäkinen actually hit a crack of vertebrae in his back as well. A mixture of stuff to prevent you from getting results.
If this was a few years later, I doubt he would have been allowed to start the event.
No way.
With that kind of back injury. Remember years ago, it might have been 2013, Breen did his back in Finland and went to Germany and did all the pre-event tests and everything, but wasn't allowed to start the event. The FIA medical person, whatever, says, no, you can't. So I'm not sure if that was... in at this stage, it was probably the end of that jumpers for goalposts drive with a broken back stuff. because there's clips there, and he is wincing coming over jumps and stuff like that. Couldn't have been good. And a shout out as well to Likes, who they still had the side of the car, the rear quarter, branded as a Charisma. They just kept that going.
Something the car lacked in it, charisma.
Oh, Jesus, it did not have that.
But the one thing is, to be fair to Mäkinen, like, he ended the day 6th overall, a minute and 18 off the lead. Okay, the reality of it is that's, you know, the guts of 80 seconds over 149k, but it's probably the least fancied car to be there, to be still in around the top 6 with very few retirements around the place. That's fair going for a man with a broken back.
Exactly. Between the broken back and the car being a pile of shit and having the standing co-driver, again, one of the drives. And like, where was he? Like, looking at the end of day one, you had the top four separated by 5 seconds. Was Mäkinen fifth or sixth, did you say?
Sixth. He was sixth. It's sixth, a minute and 17 off.
But to put context on it, Solberg was only 5 seconds behind him.
Yeah. But
yeah, Solberg wasn't fighting for a championship at this stage.
No.
Solberg had a better car, though.
Road position was helping Mäkinen there, too, on that day. And the only other thing which would have helped a lot of other drivers on pretty much any other event this year the attrition rate was actually really low on this event from the work side. They nearly all took the pace.
I think it was well, we're going to find out a certain Ford driver. And that was this pretty much. We won't spoil it.
Before stage 10 is when the road closing or road, I keep calling it road closing, road order thing happens. So before the last stage of day one. So then obviously wrapped up all the coverage ready. Sure, it's only a super special left at the end of the day. We'll Jeremy Hart and the boys start editing. And then the fucking bomb drops before stage 10.
Yeah. Did you spot what the commentator said? He actually, I don't know, what did he say to McRae? But he said, it's only a simple matter of picking the road order.
Yeah.
And it ends the episode around there. You're like, Jesus, you know, drama that was about to ensue.
Yeah, yeah. And like, what, like, you mentioned it there, Will, I think you said, Joe, this is pivotal for the championship. This is absolutely huge. I mean, Art mentioned there at the start there that McRae could have actually wrapped up the title had things fallen differently in this event, had he won and other people finished or whatever.
Let's say even if it finished, and there's probably a good chance it would have finished the way it was with the top four being like that. That put McRae losing 2 points to Burns.
Okay, so look, for anyone that isn't aware at this stage or hasn't watched the coverage, basically what happened was that, as we mentioned, the drivers were allowed to pick the running order for the following leg based on their positions at the end of each day. McRae turned up, I think they were supposed to be there 20 past 7 from memory. Don't ask me why that's in my head. I think it might be in his own book or something, but it sticks, just one of those things just sticks in my head. And he was there at 7:22. Even though the whole thing wasn't supposed to kick off till 7:30. Now, again, I could be wrong on the timings. But I think he was
still there.
Like that.
He was still there in time for his slot. So Granholm was the first to be called because he was leading. McRae was fourth going into stage 10.
Yeah.
So he would have been the fourth one called. So he wasn't there, I think, when Granholm got called up. Actually, if anyone noticed that, the late Greg Strange, that was the compere up on the ramp, who used to do iRally among a few other things. And McRae lands up, thinks, yeah, I'm there. And Gary Connolly goes, no, you're not.
It's easy to say when you're looking back at afterwards, you're looking from the outside about trying to be somebody lenient, or I know rules are rules, but I think in that context, that's harsh. I think that was way too harsh.
It probably is, and yet when you see where Gary Condy has gone since, like, Gary Condy has gone very high up in the FIA. And
he's a race steward at the F1, isn't he?
A race steward in F1. He's on the World Motorsport Council. He's a former rally competitor himself, but obviously wanted to progress in FIA. Yeah. Like, and the best thing you can do there is
follow the rules.
And suppose, as bad as it sounds, the fact that Ford did throw in an appeal and the stewards threw it out meant they hadn't a leg to stand on. And you just can't leave things to chance at that level. And it was horrible. It was shit. If it was Ireland, you get away with it. You'd probably be let in 10 minutes earlier, 10 minutes late.
But I think, wasn't there some, I didn't see, because I know nowadays you can see all the appeals and the steward's decisions from events, and they're up online.
There was something, clearly the wording of it, or the punishment was on one of those FIA yellow sheets, because in the coverage you can see the Ford team sitting around outside in the middle of the night, not in the motorhome, like outside.
Nicky Crisp's face is almost pale looking at it, kind of going...
Yeah, but Grist is looking through and he's pointing at a particular line or a particular word, going, either that's what we're going to go after or that's what we're been.
That's what you're falling on, like, yeah.
And the other thing was that this was, maybe if this was any other year, after this year, Gary Connolly isn't COC, he leaves at the end of the following year. But this was the first year that this new road order thing was in, and it was designed to make the event better so that drivers wouldn't slow down and do all the shenanigans. And he clearly had a lot of pride in what presumably he and his team had thought up, and just shafted McRae.
I only thought about it again after kind of going back on the coverage this year. I never thought about how much of an impact that had. You know?
And it was, think of everything we've had in this season so far. Like, we've had top guys going out really early on events, no one getting more than a string of two or three wins, someone not getting wins at all. Little quirks of fate here and there. And one thing that hasn't happened yet on any event is a real stamp from an organizer on an event. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, it happens here right at the end.
Right at the end.
Like, it all up.
Yeah, it is absolutely pivotal. Like, okay, Art, I kind of get where you're coming from with it. I'm an absolute spoofer, so I'm not even going to throw my opinion in with this kind of stuff. Tommy, you're probably the most seasoned competitor out of the four of us. What are your thoughts on it? Like, would you agree with what happened, or do you think it was harsh, too harsh?
Well, they were certainly correct to appeal at Ford if they felt they had grounds for an appeal. That's one thing. It was harsh, but from the nature of being a competitor, it's all about, like, Will would even agree, in as an engineer, it's about eliminating risks. And time is one of these things in rallying where you're looking to have more of it, not be looking for it. He should have been there on time. Now, whose responsibility that was is another story. Like, we don't know whether it was a miscommunication or not. The punishment didn't befit the crime, but nonetheless, he should have been there on time. Now, I don't agree with the punishment, but
the other thing.
The way I would look at it is, right, we have to be a time control out at service, right? Our out time for service is 20 past one, right? The work has to be done in the car, so we've, say, 40 minutes to do that. The time to be sitting in the car is at 1:15. You've 5 minutes to get to the control, because that makes an allowance for anything going wrong to be there in 5 minutes. Even if it's only 200 meters, be in the car 5 minutes beforehand, because it gives you that bit of space of time that, okay, if something goes wrong, I can go to the control. We're there on time, in time. Somebody's there. Not 2 minutes later. Like, the way I would have looked at that was that that's a control zone in itself.
Well, and was he, that's, I think you brought up a good point there about kind of, you know, the standards and...
As risk is, it's eliminating your risks.
No, but and I agree with that, because even, let's say, coming from the lovely, exciting, boring world of engineering, where things are regulated and controlled and things are black and white, it's either right or it's wrong, and that's it, there's no leeway. Like, the reason I think it's over the top is they're simply attending, which what I think is an event purely for media spectators, to have the drivers there go up on stage to pick their own order. I think giving a guy that much of a penalty when it's literally an event for show, when this can be all done. If this was done in a control zone with control paperwork, no problem. If he's late for it, then that's fine. But because this was a media focused event, I think it's a bit excessive.
I agree with that.
Was that a designated control zone in the roadbook? I doubt it was.
But it wasn't a penalty. It was just you're picking your road position last. You can't quantify how many seconds that's ever going to be. It was a disadvantage, yeah, but it wasn't a penalty, but it was a decision.
It was nearly worse than a penalty, because
100%.
At least with a time penalty, you can walk around that or whatever. You know where you stand. Whereas it was almost like a license to lose time here. Like, it was, I don't know. There's so many.
The only other thing I'd say on it is Ford could have taken that further again if they had wanted. You know, you can appeal the steward decision up to the FIA, but how would you appeal that? How would you get your time back? It wasn't a normal penalty, so it was a very hard thing to appeal. Clearly, the clerk of the course just said you're meant to be here at this time. You weren't here at this time. So you're not getting the pick at the time.
Didn't McRae use the words? He said, look, it was all very vague. He said he was there in the area, apparently, but that the exact... Did he have a specific time that he was supposed to be on the board or something? But you see, there's so many... You can speculate and dictate about it. You don't know. Can you see the facts on paper unless you were there? Well, I think it was over the top. Way over the top.
Just when you think... Yeah, just when you think the season couldn't come up with anything else, though.
Yeah.
It was... It was like this is the only event this year that this could have even happened on.
True, yeah.
Like,
I remember seeing this on CFAX, you know, and kind of trying to make sense of, you know, what was coming up on page 360 on BBC One. Like,
I've been horrified at the spelling of Gary Conley's surname.
Yeah. And you're kind of like, what? You know, ultimately, like, it's, I know I'm jumping the gun here. McRae was called up to the podium on at the end of day two for us as well by Greg Strange. And he said, well, Colin, what are you going to go for? I might run number one again, but no, I'll give number eight a go.
But of all people to do it to as well, of all people for that to happen to a fiery man like McRae, do you know?
There's so many pivotal moments in this season. If you look back, you know, what we've covered, the ones that spring immediately into mind are Mäkinen hitting that tree stump in Parkala, stage one of Finland, which, you know, put his whole career, if you want to look at it, into kind of a downward spiral. It was the Mitsubishi as a frontline team. You know, there were so many bits and pieces happened throughout the year. I think this, as innocuous as it might have seemed at the time, if this hadn't happened, McRae wouldn't have had to, you know, go as hard as he was going in GB. He mightn't have went off. We just don't know. Again, it's one of those things we'll never know what could have happened.
You'll get to it on GB as well, because this only crossed my mind today. And you'll talk about it more in the GB episode, I'm sure. But yeah, McRae had to push very hard there. As it happens, halfway through that event, the Ford cars were withdrawn anyway. Remember Sainz had an accident, he hit some spectators.
He did.
And like, if McRae was still in the rally at that stage,
would that have happened?
Would Ford have done? It just would have been another, it's another mad hypothetical in the season. Yeah.
There's so much, like, I know we'll be doing a summary episode at the very end once we've got a couple of more specials and the GB episode done. We're doing over an hour on each rally, but there's so much extra we could dig into still, like, you know, without boring the ass off everyone listening, it is mad. It was just another, you know, crazy occurrence in a crazy year, really. But yeah, just looking back now at the time, Joe, you said there, Tommy, the end of the coverage on Friday evening, the day one coverage, and, you know, going to bed Friday night, wake up Saturday morning, all of a sudden the whole thing was turned upside down, you know. It was just as mad, like.
And it was just when I looked at the day one coverage, and it was just a throwaway remark. And like, you know, clearly the video was in the can at that stage, you know, it was edited.
Yeah, of course, yeah, because that would have been half seven in the evening, like, so they would have had, you know, the day's footage processed and stuff like that, yeah. So
they actually have on, I'm sure you saw it when you were looking at it, they have the 52-minute the full episode, but they have each of the individual days like 26 minutes. Yeah. So there's no mention of the McRae incident at the end of day one.
I wonder, was there a visit from the Ford PR men to pull it over?
Before we finish on that, there's one last variable we never factored into this whole thing if that hadn't happened. Day two, McRae writing it off somewhere. Just saying.
Well, that was a possibility, no matter what.
If nothing else happened, we could all talk about everything could have been different in GB, but also everything could have been different the very next day.
It's actually probably the best way to quantify the penalty he got is if you go into EWRC and you just click on leg two and it gives you the results of leg two. McRae finished leg two of the rally, if leg two was all that had run, eighth behind Mäkinen. A minute 39, nearly a minute 40 seconds off Granholm. So that was the punishment he got. He was right in there on day one. Day two, as we'll see, the longest stage in the middle of it got taken out of the equation anyway. If McRae got a right run of that, running down the field, who knows where he would have finished.
That's it.
But still probably wouldn't have bet the Peugeots in the form that Granholm was in.
Exactly.
On day two.
He was fairly set up. He was set up fairly well for fourth.
Unfortunately, of course, the man himself is no longer with us to give his side of the story. But again, look, another huge factor in in the season's happenings. But we can probably talk for the rest of the episode about the right the
model. Ford went to extremes though to try and counteract it, and Francois became the sacrificial lamb.
He did, unfortunately.
What you were saying earlier, what William said about why didn't you know the other teams entice Skoda down? So the running order for day one before Ford did their shuffling was McRae, Tashi Arai, who ended up going off on the first day of the day anyway, Ericsson, McRae, and Delacour. So Delacour jumped four cars or whatever, took 13 minutes of a penalty. Like, we have no choice. This is the game. That's what he said. But why, and I don't know, maybe you can't force another team to move up the order for you. Surely some conversation or something must have been explored with Alistair in Hyundai when you run ahead of your brother, or can you? Now, obviously, you can only get your team to take a penalty. You can't force another team to do it.
Yeah.
But Alistair was leaving Hyundai anyway to go to Mitsubishi. That was done. Hyundai's rally was done after running at the front of the road anyway. And I'd love to know what conversations were had to try and get Alistair to move up the order as well, to have another
car. I'd say that they would have to be very, very careful, because you're touching the territory of the Renault scandal of Piquet Jr. there.
It is,
you could be very suspicious then. You could say, like, I know Delacroix off was massive, and it's we'll get to that point in a minute, but like, not saying it was, but it was actually advantageous for McRae in a way that happened as well. So, you know, to have the conversation with his brother and another team, yeah, I'd say a quiet hotel room chat was kind of going here, look. We need to start this out, but it's tricky. It's something I wouldn't even go into.
in your suggestion, it would have been advantageous as the fact that Delacour's accident happened on probably one of the longest stages where he stood to lose the most time.
Well, in saying that though, the rain was coming down at that point, so the road sweeping effect wasn't as strong.
Delacour was going very hard there when he went.
And out. Then, if Delacour had his accident, then McRae then was the first car on the road for the rest of the day. Yeah. Anyway, so
I don't think there was any funny stuff going on.
No, nothing for it at all. We're saying the potential of the conversation with Hyundai and some benefits there.
Yeah. See, as well, Hyundai being a Pacific team as well, down within that region too, you know. MSD were a private operation, much like ProDriver and Sport, running it for a Korean manufacturer. But I think there would be a certain element of pride there too, where something like that, granted, they're, you know, weren't going to pull up any trees anyway.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been anywhere near the strangest thing that happened this season.
No, either.
It would have been another on the list, like, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, just get on to Delacour's crash. Second rally in a row, unfortunately, with someone pretty badly injured. Delacour went off really quick section, fifth gear right hander. He just kind of ran a bit wide, clipped a tree in the left. It was kind of a narrow right left section, we'll say, and clipped the tree in the left, which threw the car back across the road. Unfortunately, hit a tree pretty much side on, and Daniel Grattle upside. I think he was caught in the car for a bit. I'm not sure.
Violent accident.
Oh, it was a sudden stop. Like, and geez, it's just weird to know that they had a huge off this following year as well. In the Lancer, they had an even bigger crash. Delacour went off and hit a tree in the Lancer at about max 7, and it was scary. Pulled the engine clean over the car and everything. Like, it was just a huge impact. But this one, anyway, the Grattle loop was pretty hot after he. Broken bones and
three broken ribs, broken collarbone, broken shoulder blade, and a collapsed lung.
So he was. But
even at that, with that kind of a side on impact at that speed, with no deceleration, it was a straight. There was no bushes to go through. It was instant impact. He got away lucky.
I was just about to say that he was lucky to come out of it. But just those injuries, especially pre-hands to waist days as well.
The side impact is the scariest, no matter what. Even like a hands to waist's impact is great, and all is there. Our effect on those kind of impacts is limited enough.
Yeah,
It is a scary one.
Anyone in any kind of motorsport knows a side impact into the door, into the B pillar, or even at the A pillar, is the worst possible accident you can have. And we can see what happened in Bergen Park as well, with Mark White and Michael Park, same accident, straight.
All the energy of the accident just went straight into the code red.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not dissipated anywhere.
I actually met Grahal up in Catalonia a couple of years ago. He was not sure when he finished up with Citroën, but he was working for Citroën at that stage.
He's a very, very slight man.
He's like wire. He's like if you said design me a co-driver, he's the guy you pick. Like he weighs about as much as a packet of Rizla.
He's like Mr. Burns.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. But no, Fierce, nice chap. Jeez, he was all chat. I'd say he was even there surprised to be recognised. He's probably so far out of the front line competition at this stage.
Do you know, actually, we were talking about the accident. That was Delacour's first major off in 7 years, they said, in the commentary.
A good run for a crazy man like Delacour. Was the previous big off inside his friend's F40 or something?
That was probably his.
It was, yeah.
But
even in 93, when he was in the Escort Cosworth, where they did that first year with the Escort, like, he had a great year in terms of he wasn't putting it off. You know, he was quick on every surface. Yeah. So, like it's like we touched on in the last episode. If you had to pick between Sainz and Delacour, you probably would have just picked Sainz, but not by much, to keep him on.
No, you wouldn't. I tell you what was interesting. I know we've touched on the last, and a few of the last ones, just about pace notes and stuff. And it's just interesting how its notes have developed since. Delacour was talking about his accident, and he goes, I was a gear too high or whatever, and it was right corner 110, presumably is 110 degrees, which is the system that Loeb and Ogier used, and other drivers.
A lot of French drivers have used it.
But it was clearly a French, I wouldn't say a French originated, but certainly the French developed it, because it was in use then. There was no other drivers at the time that we knew or saw in cars of, maybe there was, because we couldn't understand the language.
You know what? That's actually a really good point. And now you mention it, I can hear Gratloop's voice saying Son Sank, which would be 105 or whatever.
Because Delacour says that he was the right corner, it was 110. So, like, to the uninitiated, you think he's talking about speed or distance or something, but clearly when you think about it, he's talking about that. Two other funny things about that accident, because it was a bad accident. Gratteloup gets taken away in the most Australian ambulance you could ever imagine.
What was it?
It's unbelievable. It's just like a youth with a thing on the back like a horse box. It's unreal. And the other thing is the marshal that's bringing escorting Delacour back into the service area, and the marshal has his hand around Delacour. You know, just like kind of consoling him, and Delacour just go, "Get away from me!" And you know,
It's a very Delacour thing to happen, actually.
So Delacour.
I've heard Tony Simpson recently mention an absolute rally that he tried to get Delacour on for an episode, and that he blanked him inside in a bar or a cafe inside in Monaco one time. And you can absolutely imagine, like, walking up to Delacour and trying to, you know, have a quick word with him, just say, "Oh, get a photo," maybe, and him absolutely screaming at you to leave him alone, or, you know, physically assaulting you. He's that kind of guy.
Having said that, I met him at Rally Legend a few years ago. He was doing it in an Escort Cosworth, and got a photo with him and had a short chat with him, and he was a lovely fella. So
I think it's hot and cold. But also, one last point on that crash: he drove it out of the edge.
I tell you,
they don't build it like they used to, lads.
I tell you, he had to be sore too.
Yeah,
I don't like. Obviously, the navigator was hurt.
Yeah,
but he had to be sore too.
But just a point, actually, following on from what you're saying about the notes, like, there were several drivers were changing their notes, but that's probably due to the lottery of road position and where they ended up finding themselves. Like, Solberg was changing the notes, McRae was changing the notes. If you actually look at the onboard of Delacour prior to the accident, as they're coming around the hairpin right, they're changing notes as they're going through it. Like, so, like, it's kind of probably goes with the territory of Australia, where with the nature of the road surface and where you're going to be in road position, your recce is going to evolve with the notes as you're going through.
Did you say he was changing them on that stage? Something at the stage before?
I think it's the stage before, because if you watch the daily coverage as opposed to the 52-minute highlight one, if you watch the 26 minutes of day two, you can actually hear him saying back to Daniel to make an amendment. To
they're coming down into a hairpin and they overshoot it or something. I did see that. But it was just, it stood out to me, thinking how notes have developed since and how the French have gone on to dominate the WRC.
John Armstrong was using them as well for a while.
John Armstrong, I think Marion Evans uses them now, but they take the zeros off them. So instead of like right 110, it's right 11, and it goes that way.
What was Nesbitt using? Oh no, that was just absolute fucking.
That was just
Andrew got a dartboard and he threw a dartboard and picked that number.
It's like if you put your hand on a typewriter keyboard or a computer keyboard and just go every line, and just mash enter, mash enter.
And those
monkeys will write the best novel you'll ever read.
Yeah, 1,000 monkeys and 1,000 typewriters. That was Nesbitt's note.
The next piece I love about that and the coverage is something I haven't seen in a while is the piece that they have with Dave Lapworth on the cage design.
Oh yeah, that was cool actually.
Again, I'm a loser and a nerd for shell fabrication cage designs, in particularly WRC cars. Any chance I get to have a look in around some of them, it's just anyone any interest in engineering, that's just absolute.
Nah, it's cool to have those interludes, but anyway, moving on to kind of day three and stuff. To be honest, there wasn't a huge amount of change going on in terms of the leaderboard and stuff. Granholm obviously still flying. No issues with the car. He was, as we said, he was after having the best day of his career on day two, according to himself. So that was a
he even uttered the immortal phrase when being interviewed. The feeling was good.
The feeling was good. That's the Latvilla special.
Yeah.
Very good.
Burns
was going well, but he still didn't have an answer for Granholm. I know he had issues with his gearbox. He I think later on they went as well.
His engine was putting out
Yeah, the gearbox he was getting stuck in fourth, and issues with the display, the digital display as well, wasn't showing. There's obviously a sensor or something going wrong there, but he wasn't getting the readout for the gear on the display.
Which was certainly a common enough issue when those cars became customer cars.
It was actually, wasn't it? Yeah.
Jerry McGarrity had that problem, didn't he, one time?
Wasn't so usual when there were works cars, but it definitely...
Yeah, no, I think from the S7, like, they had a few issues throughout the year. We'll see there, later on in the series as well, with a couple of specials, people who were involved quite closely at the time said that, you know, they had fundamental issues with the engine installation in the car and stuff like that, which is really surprising. They mentioned that, you know, Richard had, you know, sensed that the car was down in power at the start of the year, and they couldn't figure out why, because the dyno figures were showing it to be stronger than the what was in the P2000, and turns out that there was actually an install problem. When the engine was actually in the car, it wasn't producing the same power it should have been, and it took them a couple of rallies to even sort that. So there was a lot of tooling and froing going on at ProDrive at the time. I don't want to spoil our later episodes too much, but
Neil Wearden actually even alluded to it in the episode that we did with him and Trevor, where they did the pre-event test because they were in privateer S7, I think, for GB, and like for someone coming from a privateer 206 run by Grifone, which would have been, you know, Evo 1 of the car, you know, very few, I'd say, met. Bits on it, I'd imagine. Yeah. So what essentially is this year's car, and still to remark that, the engine doesn't feel what you'd expect to be.
No, it's all relative. Like a WRC car is an awesome thing. Like it has, you know, they're crazy. If you've ever been lucky enough to be in one, like they are a fucking phenomenal bit of kit. Like especially a 2-liter car, the torque of the 2-liter cars was just crazy. Like, so you know, for someone to say that the Impreza is down on power, it's all relative, as I said, but you know, there clearly was a bit of a shortfall there. But anyway, yeah, so like the way things sort of, was there any drama in the final there that I'm
Salzburg had a puncture?
Literally nothing. So the four stages were Bannister West, Bannister North, Bannister South. Don't know what happened. Bannister East must have fell away in a storm or something.
The East side fell off in a storm. Yeah.
And then they used a section, I think, of one of the stages, one of the last ones over the jumps, as a TV stage. But it was all run-of-the-mill stuff. The only notable thing, again, is when you break it down into leg results, it was only a short leg, 100 kilometres. McRae was the fastest over that final leg by 5 seconds from Granholm, and Burns third. But there was just no one was going to catch Granholm. And Granholm would have had to have hit bother with the mileage that was left. I think even Burns admitted as much.
But even there, so you're saying, you know, with the pace McRae was at, I mean, he's still, what did he end up finishing behind Robin Perra? Robin Perra stayed fourth.
Less than
10
seconds.
Yeah, how are their times compared to each other on day three? Because it was a nice tidy driver up there.
McRae was actually quickest on three of the last four stages. And he was taking a good chunk of time out of Robin Perra on every stage.
And just wasn't enough mileage?
Just not, as you said, yeah, exactly, not enough mileage. Burns was actually quickest on the fourth stage on the Sunday. But 3 seconds out of McRae, but McRae didn't pull back. God, Jesus, 13 seconds there on the second stage. What was it? Just yeah, eight or 9 seconds in on the second half. But again, if the last stage was the longest stage, he just could have just about got there. But no, was it?
The risks, though, that he was taking and the push that he was on, like two of the most iconic shots are actually of Colin and of Richard over that jump in the Sotico complex. But there's an even earlier shot where, I don't know, is anyone familiar with, you're going proper down nerd territory of, I think it was the Jim Clark rally in 2000. Justin Dale was taking these huge cuts in a 106 max. Colin took this cut, and in modern times, they'd probably have given him a 2 minute penalty or something for it, because, you know.
Well, sure, didn't Meek get a penalty there a few years ago for putting all four wheels off?
Yeah, and Mickelson didn't, yeah.
So, like, it probably would have happened. The only kind of real surprise of the whole rally, apart from what happened to McRae, was Ariel getting his third podium on the bounce. Like, where was this coming
from?
Clearly he was out of a job with Peugeot and was canvassing for a bit of business for the following year. But out of nowhere, out of all his crying and complaining, he got three podiums on two tarmac rallies and this.
I was actually tossing him ahead of it. I was like, when we were talking about the drive of the rally, I was like obviously Graham, and then I was looking at it going, hang on now, Ariel had a great drive. I think if Brown hadn't led for as long as he did, I would have given the driver of the rally to Ariel.
Ariel didn't get rewarded with anything for the next year anyway, because he didn't have a seat for the.
He got rewarded with a P45. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, the year after he got signed by that well-known outfit of signing young and up-and-coming driver Skoda.
The old folks home. Yeah.
Yeah. he joined there after a year out, but. Clearly three podiums wasn't enough to land him a seat. Yeah. But actually, the little feature that they do, he featured in that himself. And Denny Girardet is a good-looking man.
Handsome man. Very handsome.
Very well groomed. He's your quintessential French man.
Yeah. Only drinks very, very fine wine.
No, he looks like
climb two flights of stairs on it.
He looks like one of the lads who'd run away with your wife and make you feel bad for it.
You couldn't even feel... No, you wouldn't even be mad. You'd be like, of course you ran away with him.
So classy. You did, God damn it, you're brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
The interesting thing in that is Orion says... He clearly, it's just a short and throwaway segment. Says he only likes driving and the speed is 100%, or he can be at 100%, not at 80 or 85, which obviously gives a lot of his character. You can't be like that in every event everywhere in the world, and when you've won your world championship 6 or 7 years ago, you know, your star is probably starting to fade, even though he won a rally this year. Like, that just shows how this year it was.
Mäkinen, though, I felt not a drive of the rally, but to be fair, to drive through the pain barrier and also through, you'd have to say, the technology barrier, because the car wasn't at the races with it. And like, he even made a comment about, you know, he was much happier with the car, how it was performing on gravel than tarmac. But to be fair, it was driving like a Volvo bus on tarmac.
I like the politically correctness way of saying the car was crap, calling it a technology barrier.
The car itself was a technology barrier.
The fact it had the aerodynamics of an Armco barrier.
I felt that was one of the performances of the rally for a driver who was with a navigator he wasn't entirely comfortable with, in a car that, you know, I'd say it was like throwing a dart at the dartboard with your eyes closed to get it to handle right, and have a broken vertebrae on top of it to actually get a point out of the weekend.
Must have been happy to head back to the airport and send the night and head home after the weekend of just downright bullying. He was suffering from
probably they probably forced him to buy a round of drinks for the lads before he left as well.
He was outside washing the cars before they got loaded up on
the event, and they all finish off the night, take off, and leave him with the tab.
My performance of the rally was Hyundai's PR team. I went back through crash.net looking at the releases just to see, you know, what the tone of Hyundai's releases was. So heading to Australia, they're quite hopeful. Hyundai heads for Oz Gravel with renewed vigor. So that's pre-event. Pre-event. So we're going to get something out of this.
Bit of optimism
End of day one, the optimism slowly starting to wane. Solid start for Hyundai on slippery surfaces. So they're making the best of
Hyundai starting first on the road.
Some nice alliteration there as well.
At the end of leg two, though, Hyundai fight on in crippling conditions. That's the headline of the release.
The world against them, isn't it?
And then at the very end, at the end of the rally, Hyundai sweeps Australia as championship heats up. That was their four press releases. Just superb work by whoever.
Fair play to the PR people, and I'd be the first person to absolutely jump down the throat of a PR person. But fair play to them. That was a hard thing now to put a positive spin on, but they seem to manage it anyway. So yeah, that's where we are now after the event. Just looking at the championship points. So unfortunately, Ariel and he was out of it already. Sorry, Panizzi and Robin Pera are no longer in contention for the title. So sad for them. But anyway, so the contenders are McCrean 42 points, Mäkinen 41, Burns 40, and Sainz 33. Now you'd have to say, again, Sainz is an absolute outside chance here. Unfortunately, could have gone a lot differently for him here as well had he not. The one real mistake he made all season up to this point, and he made it at the most critical time. He even said it himself. You know, it was of all the times to do it, this is the worst time to do it. But like, with the way the point structure was at the time, 10 points for the win and 6 for second. Winner takes all in GB. So you had obviously two previous winners, McCrae and Burns. Mäkinen had never won GB, had he?
He never even went well on it, ever. The only time he ever got any bit of luck there was when he wiped the wheel off the open day one and he was in the airport on the way home and Sainz blew up in the finish.
I have a feeling was he not leading in ninth or in contention in
95 he was.
Was that Ericsson, no?
No, the two of them were in amongst the front of it after day one. And I think 97, he had the flu. He only won the championship by a point. McCrae blitzed. Mäkinen was fit for nothing. Obviously, 98, we know what happened.
Yeah.
I think he's maybe had one good run in GB.
So I'd say. And
it's fairly...
Everything was moving against him there for... to lead up to that,
The only other thing, kind of mentioned it in the Gary Conley McRae episode, that one thing it did do, if you were to look at everyone's rally from Australia going into this in terms of carrying a bit of momentum, certainly took a big chunk out of McRae's momentum on the day. Like, if anyone was, because it was a season where no one got any momentum going apart from McRae in the middle of it, carrying it into the last event where you'd think some little bit of momentum would have helped. It was definitely a brilliant rally for Burns in that regard.
Absolutely.
The
fact that it happened, like, Burns couldn't have picked the last four or five events apart from him going off the road in San Remo early on to be any better in terms of the stuff that happened, like Mitsubishi pressing the self-destruct button with this new car, the Gary Conley episode, you know, it.
There was a lot of outside factors that really played into his hands. Yeah. Like, everyone just sees 2001 as McRae going off in Wales. And that's all they see. As you said, they don't
well, Burns was doing everything in the background right as well. Bauer, as you said, San Remo. There's an interesting story about that, which we'll reveal in a future episode. But, which kind of...
It was another finely judged performance, because the fact as well is that, like, he had to keep a bit of a chase on Granholm in case Granholm made a mistake. Stage 20, Granholm hit a rock and did something to the steering. No, it wasn't enough to do it, but, you know, to have sat back, you might not have been able to capitalise on that. And he obviously had Aurel still to worry about behind him. So it was a well-managed pace from him, which is something that was seen throughout the year.
But it's how he always competed. It was his philosophy for competing overall. You know, was the solid measured approach, being able to turn up when you absolutely need to, but never going to the McRae level of literally jumping in the stairs with your eyes closed. Like.
I was reading the book, and, you know, and I was watching the Walter Rahl DVD there recently, and you can see the parallels, I can now, between Burns and Rahl.
That's a good answer. That's very good.
That would be probably the driver I'd probably see Burns being closest to in his approach.
Yes, that's a good point. Anyway, yeah, so in constructors, Peugeot into the lead in the manufacturers championship, 4 points out of Ford, Mitsubishi in third, Subaru fourth. Mitsubishi third, basically thanks to Tommy. Freddie was picking up the Alpine here and there, but he was again. Where was he? Did he even finish? Where was he?
11th.
Yeah. Jesus Christ! Like, come on.
I don't even think he appeared on the footage.
I don't. Yeah, he did. When we saw the charisma.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
But anyway, and scored it in Hyundai. And interesting to note, scored at 15 points, Hyundai 13. That actually set him up for a bit of a battle in GB between themselves as to who would get the fifth place in the manufacturer standings, which we'll see in the GB episode. But yeah, that pretty much wraps us up for this week, guys.
Can we just find out one other note? The Hannigan lads and the Dehatsu finished 38th.
Nice. And won their class.
Yeah. Strong, no?
Fair play.
I was just thinking about WRC, the game that we discussed there lately, and just going through the soundtrack of it. And Soulwax have a song and it's called Much Against Everyone's Advice. A song that could be really appropriate to Freddie likes his decision back in 1998 to go to Mitsubishi. You know? It would take a Belgian band to, you know, put something about that.
Yes. Okay. So that's us for this week. We'll be back next week with a special episode, special interview. Tommy interviewed Niall McShay recently, and there's some great, great stories in that. So I'll be sure and check that out. It's really, really interesting. And the week after that, we'll have the season finale in terms of the rallies the Rally GB episode, and we've got the Gravel Cruise Jamie Arkle on board for that episode, which will be great. Jamie's you'll all know Jamie at this point if you're following that page. Jamie's a mine of information when it comes to rallying history, and just a top guy as well, so looking forward to that as well. And then we've got another couple of specials after that, which we'll reveal in due course, but rest assured they will be very, very interesting. We're looking forward to the hearing releasing those as well. So yeah, that's us. So from myself and from Tommy, William and Art, thanks again for listening, and we will speak to you next week.
Okay. Thanks for coming, lads.
Bye bye. Good luck.